Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Biden abroad. The president makes his first overseas trip to Europe to re-engage with allies and meet with adversaries. Then, insurrection aftermath. A U.S. Capitol police officer gives his first interview since the attack on Congress by Trump supporters. And rethinking college. The push for free community college nationwide gains support, but questions remain about the effectiveness of the plan. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden landed in the United Kingdom this afternoon, the first stop on his three-nation European trip. He'll begin by meeting British Prime Minister Boris Johnson tomorrow, then the three-day G7 summit that begins Friday in southwest England. Mr. Biden spoke a short time ago to American forces at RAF Mildenhall. It's a British Air Force installation.
The United States is back. And democracies of the world are standing together to tackle the toughest challenges and the issues that matter most to our future. That we're committed to leading with strength, defending our values, and delivering for our people. Democracy doesn't happen by accident. We have to defend it. We have to strengthen it, renew it. And I know that the American people are up to this job.
Our Yamiche Alcindor is traveling with the president and joins me now from Plymouth. So hello to Yamiche, to you, and safe travels. First of all, tell us about what the president's hoping to accomplish on this trip and what are the main concerns as he meets with American allies in Europe.
Well, Judy, I'm so happy to join you, especially because some cicadas at one point were delaying our plane, but we are here now in the UK. Yes, and people heard me right, cicadas. That aside, President Biden, for his first overseas trip as commander-in-chief, is really coming to a group of European leaders who are familiar with him. Experts tell me this is going to be a sort of love fest, but it's also going to feel like a family reunion. And if anyone's ever been to a family reunion, that means there will be love, but there will also be drama. There are a lot of European leaders who want to talk about trade, who want to talk about COVID vaccines and the role that the U.S. is playing, with the president expected to make some announcements on that front. There's also going to be talk of China and how to deal with it. But the president really is trying to come here to really underscore the fact that America is back, that diplomacy is something that he's going to embrace, and that America is once again going to be embracing NATO and the G7 and all of our European allies, something that his predecessor really was hostile toward.
So, Yamiche, you use the word drama. What are the most contentious issues expected to be in his meetings with the European leaders ahead of his meeting with Vladimir Putin of Russia?
Well, President Biden has known some of these European leaders for up to three decades. He's been long working on issues of foreign policy. So they're going to be real hefty talks about trade, especially when it comes to talking about the difference between Make America Great Again as well as Buy American First. There are European leaders who are really wondering if there's going to be more American protectionism on that front. There's also going to be this feeling of whether or not President Biden is a sort of placeholder because of all of the drama and all of the real contention that was there when former President Trump was coming to NATO and G7. These European leaders are going to be a bit cagey, and they really want to know if they can trust America again. And that's really a long-term issue that President Biden's going to have to deal with. And then, of course, ahead of his meeting with Vladimir Putin, there's going to be a lot of talk about January 6th and the idea that there are real issues with American democracy right now with the gridlock in Washington. So these European leaders are going to be wanting to talk about the state of American democracy. That said, the president got a big applause today when he was talking to U.S. troops, saying that he came to talk to Vladimir Putin about the things that he wants to let him know. There were no details there, but what you saw there was really a tone that was going to be firm. And the president, in some ways, has been saying that he's there to talk frankly to Vladimir Putin. So there's real expectations on that front.
And we heard some of that just a few moments ago. Yamiche Alcindor, who'll be covering all of President Biden's trip into next week. Thank you, Yamiche. In the day's other news, there's word the U.S. will buy 500 million more doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to donate to 92 low-income countries and to the African Union. About 200 million of those doses will be shared this year. The remainder will be distributed in the first half of 2022. President Biden is expected to make the official announcement tomorrow. The United Kingdom has recorded its highest daily count of new COVID cases since late February, more than 7,500. The rise is due in part to the highly contagious Delta variant first found in India. On a tour of a solar panel site, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the surge may complicate plans to reopen on June 21st.
Cases are going up, and in some places hospitalizations are going up. And I think what we need to assess is the extent to which the vaccine rollout, which has been phenomenal, has built up enough protection in the population in order for us to go ahead to the next stage.
The Delta strain is also spreading quickly here in the U.S., where it now makes up 6% of all infections. But vaccines have been effective in preventing symptoms. We'll hear some of the creative ways states are trying to increase vaccinations later in the program. President Biden today revoked a series of Trump-era executive orders that tried to ban the popular Chinese apps TikTok and WeChat in the U.S. He signed a new executive order that calls for a broad review of apps linked to foreign adversaries. It also directs the Commerce Department to analyze the risks that such apps pose to Americans' personal data and national security. The Keystone XL pipeline project to route crude oil from Canada to the U.S. has been terminated. Its Canadian sponsor, TC Energy, pulled the plug on the partially completed venture today. Environmental groups cheered the decision, which was expected after President Biden revoked a key permit. A government investigation has determined that police did not forcibly clear racial justice protesters from an area near the White House last June so that President Trump could stage a photo for the press at a nearby church. A new report from the Interior Department's Inspector General maintained that the area was cleared due to prior plans to install new fencing. The demonstration was largely peaceful before police fired tear gas. In Arizona, fire crews made some progress today against two massive wildfires burning east of Phoenix. Thousands of residents were forced to evacuate since the fires are still mostly uncontained. More than 1,000 firefighters have been battling the wildfires amid the dry heat and drought since they flared up over the weekend. A federal appeals court in Missouri blocked enforcement of a law that bans abortions at or after 8 weeks of pregnancy. The 2019 law also prohibited women from getting the procedure if their fetus was diagnosed with Down syndrome. Missouri's attorney general says they plan to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. In Afghanistan, gunmen killed 10 people and wounded 16 others in an attack on a demining charity organization. Workers with the Halo Trust were clearing unexploded landmines when armed men attacked their camp in the northern province of Baghlan.
The gunmen shot two people in the camp compound and then shot at other people inside the room. I was shot in the forehead and fell to the ground, but I got up again. And I escaped through the window.
The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. And stocks veered lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 152 points to close at 34,447. The Nasdaq fell 13 points, and the S&P 500 slid 8. Still to come on the NewsHour, the fight to vote intensifies nationwide amid dozens of restrictive proposals. The chairman of MasterCard discusses corporate responsibility in the pandemic. The push for free community college nationwide gains support, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Since the presidential election, a wave of new state measures to tighten voting laws has raised questions about access and integrity. Across the country, laws that expand access to the ballot box have passed in at least 14 states, shown on this map in green. At the same time, the 14 states in yellow have passed laws restricting access. All have Republican-controlled state legislatures. The restrictive laws have sparked outrage among voting rights groups and from two men who served as general counsels for competing presidential campaigns. Democrat Bob Bauer worked for President Obama in 2008 and 12 and advised the Biden campaign in 2020. And Ben Ginsburg, his years as a Republican election lawyer include work on the landmark Bush v. Gore dispute in 2000. And they both join me now. And welcome back to you, to the NewsHour, to both of you. Let me start with you, Bob Bauer. It isn't often these days that we see a Republican and a Democrat, prominent Republicans and Democrats, coming together on issues as contentious as voting rights. What provoked the two of you to come together on this?
Ben and I co-chaired the Presidential Commission on Election Administration established by President Obama in 2013 and reporting in 2014. And we worked on a bipartisan basis, on a bipartisan commission, toward the goal of professionalized administration of elections, and in particular, nonpartisan professional administration of elections. And over that period of time, we got to know election officials around the country, both Democratic and Republican. We came to know how hard they worked, how they received little credit for what they did well and much blame for what occasionally goes wrong. And our view was that it was really important to continue to press in this direction of nonpartisan support for what election officials do. And now we see a significant problem developing of attempts on the part of state legislatures to assert partisan control over election officials, to subject them to threats of liability and suspension if they don't perform the way that the politicians in these legislatures want them to perform. And that we view as a serious and direct threat on our democratic institutions that warrants a fully bipartisan response.
And Ben Ginsburg, I would just point out that you are a Republican and a majority, what is it, two-thirds of Republicans tell pollsters that they don't think the election was fairly carried out, that there was a lot of fraud involved, and they favor these kinds of tightening rules. So how do you square that with your support for trying to do something about these state legislatures and state laws?
There will be battles amongst the parties on the specifics of the way ballots are cast and counted. But as Bob said, we got to know a large number of state and especially local election officials. And one thing that should not be done is to politicize the actual casting and counting of ballots. That is extremely important in the democracy for everyone to realize that the way elections are tabulated is nonpartisan. And we thought it was important as these laws sort of crept into the legislative process to tell the state and local election officials that we're going to have their backs if they are prosecuted at all for doing their job.
Bob Bauer, how do you see partisanship playing a role in these laws that are being passed around the country by Republican-controlled legislatures?
This battle, I think, can be put into two categories. I mean, there have always been disagreements between the politics, between the two political parties around this fundamental conflict between one party looking to expand access and the other party troubled, it claims, by the threat of fraud restricting access in the interest of so-called election integrity. And I fall fairly squarely in the Democratic pro-access camp. However, that's one set of arguments. They've gone on for some considerable period of time. They helped shape the last enactment on this topic by the Congress, the Help America Vote Act, immediately after the Florida recount. But there's another battle line, and that's over whether or not we're going to respect the fundamental institutions, as Ben just said, by which we administer the electoral process, whether we're going to depoliticize or protect those institutions from being depoliticized, from being politicized. And that is something that a new battle has broken out about, the attempt of politicians to intimidate and harass election officials, to call into question the work that they do, both in the original count of ballots and then subsequently in recounts, That is a profound attack on democratic institutions, and that's something around which the two political parties should agree action needs to be taken to prevent it.
And Ben Ginsburg, how do you propose to, do you think you can have success persuading these Republican state legislators who think it's time now to rein in state election officials, as those in Georgia who said they were, what they were fighting for was a free and fair election?
Well, I think there'll be more success in some places than others. But one of the things that I think is true and which my fellow Republicans are not taking into account is that when you pass laws like this, what goes around comes around. And that, in point of fact, if you try and nullify election results in one state by pressuring state and local election officials, that's going to have an influence on all candidates in that state. And that can hurt Republicans as much as Democrats. I think it is naive to think that if, for example, the provisions that the weaponized poll watchers in polling places are just going to be implemented by Republican poll watchers in Democratic precincts, they're sadly wrong. That in fact, Democrats will do the same thing to preserve their votes, and the end result will be a very muddled election in which people don't have faith in the results, and that has real consequences for the democracy.
Bob Bauer, what about that? And I do want to bring into this the big voting rights bill that is right now apparently stalled in the United States Senate with the Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia saying he's not going to support it. He thinks it's not bipartisan enough. Do you see remedies in that piece of legislation to address your concerns, your and Ben Ginsburg's concerns at the state level?
Well, I'll begin by saying, I mean, there are some important provisions of H.R. 1 and S.1. It's a broad, as you know, it's an omnibus reform bill, and it deals with a lot of topics. But it does set some federal voting standards that I think are very healthy and important. But what it was developed over a period of time when I don't think we all recognize the extent of the threat, the institutional threat that Ben and I are concerned with. And so as this reform debate continues, it seems to me that those sorts of protections need to be added to any congressional debate, to any reform agenda. But in the meantime, at the state and local level, there are steps that can be made to do what Ben suggested, which is to have election officials know that Democrats and Republicans alike have their back. And the network of lawyers that we're recruiting around the country, Democrats and Republicans, to defend them, I think is a really important step. And it doesn't rely on breaking through any stalemate in the Congress at the present time.
And please pick up on that, Ben Ginsburg. What do you see as an appropriate remedy at the federal level for what concerns you?
Well, there will always be concerns about federally legislating elections on the state and local level. But there are parts of the bill, of H.R. 1, that could be done. But the Democrats are making a huge tactical error if they really care about these election situations and even about the voting rights situations and having so many other provisions in this bill. And you talked before about how Republicans are trying to tilt election results by the state legislation. That's true. But the Democrats are trying to do the same thing in S1 through a number of provisions that are just designed to give them a political advantage. So if they actually want to deal with the voting issues, it's time to kind of do the obvious and concentrate on those issues and strip away the other provisions.
We're just about out of time, but Bob Bauer, do you agree with that, that's what Democrats are doing?
No, I don't. I mean, Ben and I have over the years have disagreed on many things, and we don't agree about that. We do agree, however, that we have to defend our democratic institutions.
And we thank the two of you for coming on to talk about that. Bob Bauer, Ben Ginsburg, we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And As we reported earlier, President Biden is expected to announce tomorrow that the U.S. will purchase 500 million more doses of COVID vaccines that will be donated to the world's poorest countries and the African Union. This announcement comes as leaders in the private sector are stepping up their efforts to aid in the pandemic response. Amna Nawaz explains.
In one of the largest private sector donations of its kind, the MasterCard Foundation announced today they'll give $1.3 billion over the next 3 years to vaccinate 50 million people on the continent of Africa. Fewer than 2% of the people who live in Africa have gotten a single dose of the vaccine yet. That's far lower than many of the wealthiest countries and well below the global average of 11%. Ajay Banga is the executive chairman of MasterCard, and he joins me now. Ajay, welcome to the NewsHour, and thank you for making the time. $1.3 billion. It's one of the largest private gifts in the entire pandemic. Why this much and why now?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. The fact is that this whole pandemic is something that we've all got to put our shoulder to the wheel at. It's not enough to say that governments will fix it. It's not enough to say that somebody else will do it or some other company will or some other foundation will. And so we're all trying to do our best. And there are lots of governments and companies that are doing their best. And the foundation is an independent foundation. It was created at our IPO and runs independently. They have our name and we are the only donor. And I'm very proud of their CEO and their chair on this decision. So basically, the idea is that they work in Africa, they help to do economic development in Africa. And how can you have economic development in a continent which hasn't yet got vaccinations for its citizenry? So the objective here is to kickstart the process with a large enough donation to get 50 million people vaccinated, but also to build infrastructure and capabilities and training through the African CDC and the African Union for this to become a real operational opportunity.
Let me ask you about some of the activity you've taken in Central America, though, because this is something that's very central to the Biden administration's efforts there. Vice President Harris is wrapping up a trip to the region. She's there on a mission to try to address the root causes, causing people to flee in the first place to address irregular migration. MasterCard's made a commitment to invest in the region. Why? What do you see as MasterCard's role in this part of the administration's efforts?
So I think that no company grows when the communities around it are not successful and growing. The same idea applies to the Northern Triangle. When the administration said we want to find a way to help people stay where they are, I'm not somebody who can open a manufacturing factory or an export factory from there, but I can help in the distribution of aid digitally and reduce some of the corruption and leakage that happens through normal aid distribution. And that's the idea of saying, we'll help 5 million people come into the financial mainstream in the Northern Triangle and help 1 million SMEs get digitally enabled. That's the starting point of the commitment to the Vice President's effort.
I want to get your take on where we are right now in the U.S. in terms of the economic recovery, because last year you said you were worried about what people call a K-shaped recovery, that the inequality gaps that persisted in the pandemic would continue to get wider. Based on what you've seen so far, are you still worried about that?
Yes, I am. I will say that I am very optimistic in general about the state of the U.S. economy. I believe that the package of measures that the system has put into place from monetary and fiscal policy, as well as all the things that I see underlying in the economy, are very constructive. But the problem is, overall, U.S. GDP will do well, but we've got to worry about those that are getting left behind. And we know that during the pandemic, women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, women and minorities in jobs suffered disproportionately compared to others. And we know that the digital divide exists, right? Now, just to be clear, the pandemic didn't suddenly create all this. It's exposed issues in our society that have existed for a while. And I think we need to build back better. We need to do this better. And just in case the digital divide, which is where the K-shaped recovery idea comes from, the digital divide will actually make it worse, right? If you can't get access to broadband or infrastructure of that type, whether you're an SME or a student, that's not a great place to be. It's the same for the unequal spread of vaccinations across the world between some developed markets and other developing countries. And that's one of the reasons why the MasterCard Foundation made this commitment. So it's kind of all intertwined. The idea of we're in it together, and if we're going to come out of it, we're going to have to come out of it together. This beast is going to need your shoulder and my shoulder at the wheel.
Well, you mentioned some of those gaps. The White House will argue that one of the ways to close those gaps is with these big spending plans they're proposing, like the infrastructure package. And they say as part of that, that companies like yours should pay higher taxes to help pay for them. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, listen, we benefited when the taxes came down. We put a lot of the money we got from those tax breaks into our philanthropy as well as into our employees for 401k matches of a much higher level. One of the facts that people don't know about us is if you put in 6% into your 401k in our company, we match you 10, meaning you get 16. That's one of the fewest or the rarest examples of that kind of effort. We did that with the tax savings. If taxes go back up, that's policy. We got to learn how to live with it and play with it. My real response here is it's actually about competitiveness. So if you need to fix the taxes at a level that you think makes sense for what the government's revenue should be, go ahead and do that. Make sure we're all competitive because global multinationals have got an opportunity to keep growing and doing good things for the American population and the American system. We can't if we're uncompetitive. That's all. So make it competitive, and we have to carry our share. I don't have a problem with a tax rate that is higher than where we are today, so long as I understand and appreciate that it's competitively introduced.
There's another key issue I want to get your take on, which is the string of high-profile cyber attacks that we've seen, these ransomware attacks, how quickly and dramatically they have brought parts of American life to an absolute standstill in the global banking world right now. How secure are financial services? How worried are you about MasterCard being hacked?
Well, you know, I've been involved in cybersecurity for a while, both at the company but also at different presidential commissions. And I will tell you that I've been making a case that we're only as strong as our weakest link. Now, MasterCard's been one of those beneficiaries of people trying to get at us for a long time, and we have built fairly strong processes, and so have most of the financial services industry. And now, where we are today, the financial services industry works very closely across the industry, but also with government. And so I think you'll find that America's financial services industry is in relatively good shape. But remember, you're only as strong as your weakest link. So think about all the supply chain that interacts with financial services or any company for that matter. If those supply chain is not as strong as it needs to be, you expose yourself to weakness. So, you know, cybersecurity is a real issue, and no single company can fight off nation states or very large organized criminal gangs beyond a point. And so I think we're in this together, a bit like the pandemic. Cyber is also a pandemic of a different type. And we need to just put our shoulder to the wheel together across industry and government. This is a place where the hackneyed words of public-private partnership actually mean a great deal.
Ajay Banga is the executive chairman of MasterCard. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
We return now to the debate over providing free tuition for community college students. Last night, we heard the case against President Biden's effort to create a nationwide free program. As a reminder, his plan starts with $109 billion to cover full tuition for community college. The plan also includes an $85 billion investment in Pell Grants for students in need at both 2- and 4-year colleges. And there's another $62 billion for resources to help students complete their degree. Tonight, we get a different perspective on this proposal for our series, Rethinking College. I'm joined by John King, the former U.S. Secretary of Education under President Barack Obama and former New York State Education Commissioner. He's now president of the Education Trust. It's an advocacy group working to close opportunity gaps from preschool through college. He also is seeking the Democratic nomination to be Maryland's next governor. John King, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thank you for being here. So you like President Biden's proposal for free community college, free tuition. Why?
Well, it's hugely important. You know, if you look at the economic recovery after the 2008 financial crisis, nearly all of the new jobs that were created went to people with some level of post-secondary education. That might have been a 4-year degree, often was an associate's degree or even a career and technical education certificate. So we know that investing in community college can help to spur economic recovery. We also know it improves people's life circumstances. Folks with a college degree earn more than $1 million more over the course of their lifetime. So this is really an investment. I know folks want to talk about it as an expense, but really have to think about it as an investment. The evidence is the return on investment of more students with community college degrees will more than pay for the cost of this investment.
Well, last night, as you know, we spoke with another former Secretary of Education, Margaret Spellings, who had that job under President George W. Bush. Her argument, though, against this is that so many of these students in community college don't complete their time. They don't get to the associate degree. And the money would be better spent in other ways. What about that?
Well, two things. One, we know that for many community college students, the very reason they don't complete is they don't have the financial support they need. And what President Biden envisions here is really a state-federal partnership to get students the resources they need, not just to start, but to finish. There's also, as you mentioned, the $62 billion investment in additional supports for students, better advising, access to childcare, access to mental health services, the kinds of supports that evidence shows greatly increase completion, particularly for low-income students and students of color. So this is a very carefully thought through package of reforms. As you know, states have disinvested in public higher ed over the last few decades. This is an opportunity to change that by saying public higher education is going to help us build a stronger economy for the long term.
We also heard from Margaret Spellings last night, John King, the argument that when students go to what she called a traditional, a comprehensive university, like an HBCU, historically black college, they get more support. As she called it, more likely to get what she called help for a trajectory into a livelihood, the kind of thing that just doesn't exist in many community colleges.
Well, look, this plan also includes a very significant investment in historically black colleges and universities and minority-serving institutions. The reality is we need a mix of strategies, where you have some students who are only going to want that community college degree. They're going to need very specific skills to advance in their career, whether that's in an emerging field like cybersecurity or a traditional field like logistics. So this is an opportunity to help support folks who may need this degree to better support their family, to move up at their job. I think really what President Biden is aiming for here is a vision for a society that helps people improve their own lot in life through education. And shouldn't we all support that?
And just finally, John King, I want to quote a conservative economist, Glenn Hubbard, who wrote a piece about this and arguing against free tuition in community colleges. He said, if you do this, it's just going to flood colleges with students and make them less inclined to experiment or to collaborate. How about that?
I mean, that strikes me as deeply misguided. I think we have some good evidence here. Actually, Governor Haslam, the Republican governor of Tennessee, was the first to really lead on this with a statewide community college tuition-free program. And the evidence is it's attracting, yes, more students, but it's also helping to increase completion rates. It's increasing the transfer rates from two-year colleges to four-year colleges. And it's creating new pathways to economic opportunity for folks who historically have been locked out of economic success. This is a Republican idea that President Biden is advancing because it's good for the long-term health of our economy.
John King, former Secretary of Education, it's an important debate. We're very glad to have you here to participate in it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
A day after the release of a Senate report detailing the widespread security failures in the January 6th Capitol riot, our Lisa Desjardins sat down for an exclusive interview with one of the police officers who was on the scene that day.
It was a chaotic scene marked by tragedy and heroism. Officer James Blasingame, 17-year veteran of the Capitol Police, thank you for joining us. You're here along with your lawyer, Patrick Malone, who's representing you, and a fellow officer in a civil lawsuit against former President Trump over harm done from the January 6th riot. He requested to be present for this interview. Tell me what happened that day.
That's something that I try to process and go through from time to time. What happened? How did it happen? It was an insurrection, you know. It was a significant amount of people that felt aggrieved and felt that invading the Capitol to impose their will was an appropriate action. It looked like a zord of horde of zombies, you know, just people as far as you could see just salivating and
faces and bodies and
yeah, and they're tugging on the officers and you know they're in danger and there's nothing we can do. And then I hear somebody yell they're coming in a window. So go towards the north side, the center side of the Capitol, and there was some door. Nobody can get inside the door. You know, that Capitol is kind of an old place and mm-hmm. some things are antiquated. So we roll out towards the center of the rotunda looking north, and you just hear just noise and people running at me as far as I can see, from the crypt all the way to the north side, center side of the Capitol, just running at us. And I look to my left and to my right, and there's like maybe 8-9 of us, and I'm thinking, sorry. And they kind of leak out, and there's like we're holding a line, but there's no line we're holding because there's an insurmountable amount of people, and there's like 8-9 officers. And
it's a massive space.
I'm 39 years old. I've never been called a to my face in 39 years. Might have been called a but I've never been called one to my face. Mm. That streak ended on January 6th. Mm. I was called a I was called a traitor. I was called, you know, various epithets.
What are you thinking at this point? How are you making decisions?
I don't want to make it seem like braggadocious, like there was no fear. Like, absolutely, there had to have been some fear, but I don't think there was time for fear. It was, I have to make it home. Like, I have to survive this. I've been on the department 17 years. I've never been in a situation where I felt I had to use my weapon. That was a situation where I was pegging. I was like, okay, this is it. And the only reason why I didn't do it was because the mentality was this is a four-alarm blaze. And if I pull my gun out and start shooting, I'm throwing kerosene on it. Hmm. Maybe there's a chance I survive if I don't pull my weapon. But if I do, I'm probably not going to make it out of here alive, you know? You don't have enough bullets.
I want to help people understand that we've seen a lot of pictures from outside of the Capitol. The places you were some of the most dangerous and difficult confrontations in the Capitol, but you weren't unharmed.
I would say it's much more like emotional and mental than anything else, you know, because we can't really move past it. You know, we're something as simple as a commission, you know, being passed or, you know, trying to take that on, you know, at the end of the day, as bad as it was, like, we did our job. Like, no member of Congress was harmed, you know? And to have to see these people every day and they don't have our back, something as simple as just trying to find out what happened so that it doesn't happen again, because my fear is this was the tip of the iceberg. You know, you have a lot of people that are radicalized, that this is exactly what they wanted to do, you know? And it's in. By there being no accountability, it's emboldening them.
I want to play some sound of what some lawmakers have said in recent months, a different narrative from Republican lawmakers who question whether how serious January 6th was. I want to play that and get your thoughts on it, if you can listen.
Okay.
You know, if you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January the 6th, you would actually think it was a normal tourist visit.
Was January 6th an insurrection, or could it be more accurately described as a mob of misfits?
I condemn the violence, but to say there were thousands of armed insurrectionists, breaching the Capitol, intent on overthrowing the government, is just simply false narrative.
What do you say?
I would think that certain things are above politics. It's deplorable to say, as bad as it looks on film, believe me, it was much worse. You know, they can stitch together as much footage as they want to, but I'm telling you, and anybody that was in that scrum will tell you, it was much worse in person than anything you're ever going to see on film. And for the narrative to be modified or changed so that it's trying to make it seem something other than what it was, it's disheartening, you know, especially, you know, we go to work every day and we have to protect, you know, members of Congress, and for them to come and say, you know, thank you for your service and appreciate what you do, but you don't, because this is very simple, just having a commission to find out what happened so this doesn't happen again, you know, because I personally feel that, again, this is something that is a very real threat moving forward.
Your lawsuit charges President Trump himself with directing and enabling this attack. Why focus on him? Why do you believe he's responsible?
Well, there's no shortage of people that are responsible, but I think that the most powerful human being on the planet, if the most powerful human being on the planet is not held accountable, can do whatever they want to do, what does that say about our democracy as a whole?
And we've reached out to the former president for comment on your lawsuit. We have not heard back from them at this point. At this time, there's also a report we just got yesterday from the Senate, a bipartisan report. And among the findings in that report was one that the U.S. Capitol Police was not adequately prepared to prevent or respond to the January 6th security threats, which contributed to the breach of the Capitol. Do you agree with that?
I don't speak for the department. I think the report speaks for itself. I think there are things that could have been done to put officers in a position to be successful that weren't done.
Do you think the U.S. Capitol is secure right now?
I don't think I'm qualified to answer that question.
James Blatzengame, Patrick Malone, thank you very much for talking with us and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
And we'll be back shortly. From cold beer to cold hard cash, we look at new incentives to get the COVID vaccine. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps keep programs like ours on the air. Prior to the pandemic, Broadway was booming, breaking box office records in 11 of the last 12 years. But COVID closed the curtains. Now the lights are coming back. Springsteen on Broadway opens on June 26th, and audience members will be required to show proof of full COVID-19 vaccination to enter. Jeffrey Brown reports for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Rousing music and thrilling energy.
I'm past patiently waiting, I'm passionately smashing.
Soaring language and high drama.
Let's begin by restoring this man to his family.
Broadway is all that, but now it's closed, and the pandemic has exposed how much more there is to it.
I don't think most people think of actors, for example, as the middle class workers that the majority of us are. They also don't really think about the arts and entertainment industry's impact on the economy.
Kate Schindel is an actor whose credits include the national tour of Fun Home. Now she's an out-of-work actor who also happens to be president of the Actors' Equity Union, a non-paying job, by the way, dealing closely with an industry in crisis.
Look, making a living in our industry, being a professional actor or stage manager, is one of the hardest things you can do, even on a good day. It's an incredibly unstable and unpredictable way to make a living.
I'm a song and dance man. I've worked all over the country, a few national tours. I've gotten to work here in New York at Lincoln Center. The career was great until it wasn't anymore.
For years, 37-year-old Rashawn James II did what actors and dancers have always done: work when they get gigs, supplement their income as waiters, bartenders, and doing other odd jobs.
I was an alcohol slinger. I would stand inside of liquor stores and give tastings, and I got a percentage of the bottles that I would sell.
With that work also gone, James turned to even odder temporary jobs, working for the census, then as a poll worker, and now, to his immense surprise, as deputy campaign manager for a friend running for city council in Manhattan.
Who I am is being redefined every day, because now someone asks me, well, what do you do? It's like, oh, I work in politics. So in that way, I'm redefining myself.
While most of us focus on what happens on stage, commercial theater is an enormous ecosystem.
Oh, nice. I didn't realize they'd done these yet.
Playing out largely behind the scenes in places like this.
Awesome. We're the department that's really good at putting our heads down and getting the job done. We don't really make a fuss. We don't want to be noticed.
John Christensen's 20-year-old company makes the costumes for Broadway shows and performances of all kinds. It's highly specialized, made-to-order work, performed by skilled artisans. Christensen laid off all of his 52 workers, and with little work, has less than a third on hand now.
When it started to become terrifying was when things were happening, like Disney closing Frozen on Broadway because it was too hard to open it up again. And we started to see this shift, trying to get people to talk to us, figure out what to do for our people, who are my family.
Now Christensen has joined more than 50 other shops to form the Costume Industry Coalition, fighting for their very survival.
These costume shops are all small businesses.
The group released videos with celebrity testimonials and demonstrations of all that goes into the making of a costume.
The people that are doing their beading, sewing the garments and putting the thread in. It's a lot of people that are doing this, each one very important. We need to make sure that they make it through this.
It's one of many relief efforts. Since last March, the Actors Fund has given $18 million in emergency financial assistance to more than 15,000 people.
My insurance is running out at the end of March.
And holds Zoom seminars like this for those whose insurance has run out. In December, Tina Fey hosted an NBC special, One Night Only, The Best of Broadway, that raised more than $3 million. And the coronavirus relief package passed by Congress in December included $15 billion for Save Our Stages, aid for venues from small clubs to Broadway theaters.
In New York City.
Others help in their own ways. When the long-running TV show Law & Order SVU resumed production in September, executive producer Warren Light announced he would hire as many unemployed theater actors as possible, more than 30 so far.
We were aware that people were losing health insurance in Broadway. People it's been a tough time. We just thought, let's not fly people in from other cities. Let's not look so much to the TV acting pool. Let's try and keep the local Broadway pool that we've always relied on. Let's help as much as we can.
Plus, Light says his show benefits from the talents of suddenly available top Broadway stars.
The objection is sustained.
Several, including Tony Award winner Adrian Lenox, have played judges.
Judges need a certain kind of authority, and if you can hit the back wall of the Winter Garden, you can handle arraignment court here.
Of course, there are only so many judges, even on the Law & Order franchise. The real questions: when will Broadway return, and what will it look like?
We have had no revenue for 9 months now. We most likely won't have it for another 8 months. We are the first industry that went out and will most likely be the last one in.
Charlotte St. Martin, president of the Broadway League, the trade group for commercial theater in the U.S., says Broadway faces unusually daunting challenges.
Broadway is a very, very expensive business. We looked at socially distancing because the state was asking us to try. And the most seats that we could fill in the biggest theater was 27%. We need 75% for most shows to even break even.
For now, St. Martin and others say the focus must be on sustaining the people and the work they do that make up this great American industry. So there will be an industry to return to. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
The growth of the so-called Delta COVID variant in the UK and more recently in the US is worrying health officials. Vaccines have proven effective against all the variants, particularly when someone is fully vaccinated. But the pace of inoculations in the US is slowing. Last week, the US was averaging about 800,000 doses a day, well below this spring when 2.5 to 3 million were being given each day. The Biden administration's goal of getting 70% of adults inoculated with at least one shot by July 4th is looking harder. Given that, a month-long campaign has begun with incentives from state governments, sport leagues, and businesses, all to get people to roll up their sleeves. William Brangham has the story.
Do it for yourself. Do it to protect those more vulnerable than you, your friends, your family, your community.
While roughly 140 million Americans eagerly lined up for their shots, officials are trying creative new ways to get the rest of the country into a vaccination center. Is transportation the problem? Uber and Lyft have now partnered with the White House to offer discounted rides to vaccination sites. Major League Baseball teams are offering free tickets to people who get their jabs at the ballpark. There's free beer being offered to vaccinated adults in multiple cities.
So one of the reasons I came out here, it's my day off. Free beer is better than the beer you pay for, so it's a nice day to bring a dog out to a park.
Anheuser-Busch says if the country meets the Biden administration's 70% vaccination goal by July 4th, it'll offer 200,000 people a free round to celebrate independence from the virus. United Airlines frequent flyers can upload their vaccination card for a shot to win free flights for a year. But one of the sweetest rewards, Krispy Kreme is giving away free donuts for the inoculated through the end of the year.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, Krispy Kremes are delicious.
The vaccination is a reward all by itself. I mean, you know, that is the reward in staying alive. But the donut is just like a little pat on the back.
In the nation's capital, where marijuana possession is legal, home growers offered free pot to those getting their shots.
Just like they're giving away Krispy Kreme donuts, we're giving away joints.
Washington State, in tandem with its commercial cannabis industry, announced a similar so-called Joints for Jabs promotion.
$50,000, 15 people.
And for those who want a shot at winning a fortune with their shot, several states have rolled out lotteries with scholarships and prizes ranging from $10,000 to $1 million.
A stable future after the last year that we've had is worth all the money in the world. But, of course, it doesn't hurt to take your chance at $1 million as well.
All right, Ed, you're all finished.
And in West Virginia, a state that had one of the most successful initial rollouts, newly vaccinated young adults are offered $100 gift cards and the chance to win free vacations in state parks, college scholarships, and one of five custom-made shotguns. It's hard to know how effective these incentives are at motivating the hesitant.
Two lucky Ohioans are about.
But in Ohio, at least, the Vax-a-Million lottery seems to be working. In the first week after the program began, the state saw a 28% increase in the vaccination rate for those 16 and older. And for those who don't win $1 million, there will still be donuts. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
Let's hope it all works, and let's hope everybody who can gets vaccinated. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.